This is Bridget.
And this is Annie.
And you're listening to Stuff Mom Never Told You. Now, today, I want to give a quick trigger warning because we're going to be talking about more Me Too and sexual violence and sex crimes. So if that is something that is difficult for you to listen to, just know that that is what today's episode is all about. On this show, we have talked quite a bit about Me Too, sexual violence, sex crime, sexual harassment, and I feel like we've actually been pretty intentional about talking about the different avenues of it when the victim is a man, you know, different industries. But this is the first time that we're really getting into what happens when the perpetrator is a woman and a notable feminist.
And for a little background, female perpetrators of sexual abuse are understudied, but according to a peer-reviewed study, The Sexual Victimization of Men in America, new data challenged old assumptions in the American Journal of Public Health, men are more likely to be victims of sex crimes than we thought. For example, the CDC's nationally representative data revealed that over 1 year, men and women were equally likely to experience non-consensual sex, and most male victims reported female perpetrators. Over their lifetime, 79% of men who were made to penetrate someone else, a form of rape in the view of most researchers, reported female perpetrators. And likewise, most men who experienced sexual coercion and unwanted sexual contact had female perpetrators. And when women are behind bars and sexually abused by prison staff, the perpetrator is usually female. Quote, we found that, contrary to assumptions, the biggest threat to women serving time does not come from male corrections staff. Instead, female victims are more than 3 times as likely to experience sexual abuse by other women inmates than by male staff.
Yeah, and so what this data really shows us is that, one, we aren't really doing a lot to look into what happens and what it looks like when a woman is the person who is the perpetrator of a sex crime. And two, kind of going back to our episode on Terry Crews, we're not really fully acknowledging the depth to which men are and can be the victims of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, rape, and all of that. It just seems like in general, this is a conversation that is sort of going unhad, unreported, understudied, and all of that. Which brings us to the case of Avital Ronnell. Ronnell is a world-renowned female professor of German and comparative literature at New York University, and she was found responsible for sexually harassing a male former graduate student named Nimrod Reitman. According to the New York Times, they've really done the most sort of extensive reporting on this case. According to the Times, an 11-month Title IX investigation found that Professor Ronnell, described by a colleague as, quote, one of the very few philosopher stars of this world, was responsible for sexual harassment, both physical and verbal, to the extent that her behavior was, quote, sufficiently pervasive to alter the terms and conditions of Mr. Reitman's learning environment. Now, the professor has been suspended for the coming academic year.
Reitman said that she had sexually harassed him for 3 years and shared dozens of emails in which she referred to him as, quote, my most adored one, sweet cuddly baby, cocker spaniel, and my astounding and beautiful Nimrod.
Gross. That cocker spaniel one.
Yeah.
For someone who's supposed to be like a linguist, girl, come on.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Reitman, who is now 34 and is a visiting fellow at Harvard, says that Professor Ronnell kissed and touched him repeatedly, slept in his bed with him, required him to lie in her bed, held his hand, texted, emailed, and called him constantly, and refused to work with him if he did not reciprocate. Mr. Reitman is gay and is now married to a man, and Professor Ronnell is a lesbian.
Now, Reitman says that everything really started in 2012 when the professor invited him on a trip to Paris. This is before he was officially a student at the university. He had been admitted, but had not actually started classes, but she was still set up to be his faculty advisor. Now, during this trip, he said that she asked him to come into her bedroom and read poetry to her while she was taking a nap. He says that, you know, he was kind of weirded out by this, but was like, oh, I'm here. I better not rock the boat. Better not make a scene. So he did it. And as he was doing it, she pulls him into his bed, he alleges, and started kissing him on his torso, on his face, on his hands, and trying to grope him. The next day, a similar kind of thing happened. And he said, listen, you're my advisor, I'm your student, this is not okay, this shouldn't happen. And when they got back to New York, her power was knocked out in 2012 by Hurricane Sandy. And so she showed up to at his apartment asking to stay and insisted on staying in his bed. And again, just like in Paris, once in his bed, she groped him, kissed him, he alleges, and all of that. And so it really just sounds like a very familiar story, you know, where someone with more power is texting you, emailing you, calling you, putting you in these sort of positions, only the genders are flipped.
Yeah. And the New York Times obtained emails that she sent to him. Quote, "I woke up with a slight fever and sore throat," she wrote in email on June 16th, 2012. "I will try very hard not to kiss you until the throat situation receives security clearance. This is not an easy deferral." In July, she wrote a short email to him, "Time for your midday kiss. My image during meditation. We're on the sofa, your head on my lap, stroking your forehead, playing softly with your hair, soothing you, headache gone. Yes." Question mark.
So that pretty clearly reads like sexual harassment to me. I don't know how anyone could think that those are appropriate emails to be sending if you're a professor that you're sending to your student. You know, that's pretty clearly not okay. You know who does think it's okay is the professor. She denies all of these allegations. She says, "Our communications, which Reitman now claims constitute sexual harassment, were between two adults, a gay man and a queer woman who share an Israeli heritage, as well as a penchant for florid and campy communications arising from our common academic backgrounds and sensibilities. These communications were repeatedly invited, responded to, and encouraged by him over a period of 3 years. She said she had no idea that he was uncomfortable with these communications and this behavior until she got this Title IX complaint. There's a lot to unpack in that statement. I don't kind of know what she means that, oh, we're both Israeli and we both enjoy camp. This is a campy conversation. I sort of almost don't understand how this serves as a excuse for those emails, which she does not deny sending.
Yeah. When I read that, my brow is kind of furrowed. I'm not sure what she was going for other than maybe like, this is just how we like to communicate. I thought this was reciprocated, but...
Yeah, maybe it's the idea is that we both have the same cultural heritage and we have a very close relationship that might appear suspicious on the outside, but it's actually just the way that we talk to each other. That's the only thing I can think. Otherwise, I'm just like, you're both Israeli, so it's okay for you to sexually harass him? What? Like, does not compute.
Yeah. And her response is pretty much standard for how men react when they are accused of misconduct. As Vox puts it, "Ronell's response to the allegations also echoes those of other powerful people, many of them men, accused as part of Me Too. She has asked why Reitman didn't speak up, if he was uncomfortable, and argued that he was just upset because of his intellectual inferiority. Quote, his main dilemma was the incoherency in his writing and a lack of recognizable argument, she said in an interview that was part of the Title IX process.
So it really is, it just sounds like the same way that men respond when they are accused of sexual misconduct. It's like reading from a script. And it makes me really sad that as someone who is both an academic and a feminist, that she does not see that she's following this well-worn script of how abusers respond when they're called out for their abuse.
In May, the university found Professor Ronell responsible for sexual harassment and cleared her of the other allegations.
And it has to be said that the fact that she was cleared of the allegations of things like groping, he's alleging these things happened when it was just them two alone in apartments together. So take that for what it's worth, right? That the university clearly found her in violation of sexually harassing him, but they are not able to confirm that she groped him, she kissed him, all of that, because those things happened. He alleges they happened while they were alone together.
Yeah. And now Reitman and his legal team are thinking about suing the university. John Beckman, a spokesman for the university, wrote in a statement to The Times that NYU was sympathetic to what Mr. Reitman had been through. But Mr. Beckman added, quote, given the promptness, seriousness, and thoroughness with which we responded to his charges, we do not believe that his filing a multi-million dollar lawsuit against the university would be warranted or just.
Yeah, and we're going to have a little bit more on why the university response to what happened was so complicated after this quick break. And we're back. So here's where things really take a turn. This professor, her colleagues, really kind of made a big show of public support for her. They all sign an open letter to the university, basically saying she's done nothing wrong. Do not punish her. I mean, I have to say, frankly, I was pretty disappointed in this behavior. The people who signed onto this letter are some of the most important feminist critics and scholars that the world has. I'm talking people like Judith Butler, who, you know, I studied quite a bit when I was getting my degree in women's studies and when I was in graduate school. Judith Butler is the author of Gender Trouble, which is probably one of the most defining texts of feminist theory and criticism that we have. And it just astounds me that she would attach her name to a letter like this.
Yeah, especially when I guess the results are not final, like the investigation is still sort of ongoing.
Another really important feminist critic and scholar who signed on to this letter is Gayatri Spivak, who, again, is one of the most important feminist scholars in the world. I'm kind of shocked and baffled that these women would sign on to this. So here's what the letter said. Although we have no access to the confidential dossier, we've all worked for many years in close proximity to Professor Runnell and accumulated collectively years of experience to support our view of her capacity as a teacher and a scholar, but also as someone who has served as chair of both the departments of German and comparative literature at New York University. We've all seen her relationship with students, and some of us know the individual who has waged this malicious campaign against her. We wish to communicate first, in the clearest terms, our profound and enduring admiration for Professor Runnell, whose mentorship of students has been no less than remarkable over many years. We deplore the damage that this legal proceeding causes her, and seek to register in clear terms our objection to any judgment against her. We hold that the allegations against her do not constitute actual evidence, but rather support the view that malicious intention has animated and sustained this legal nightmare.
First of all, they flat out say, you know, we don't know the information that's out there about this case. So they start out their letter by saying, listen, we don't know the facts. But we do know that this professor is great. She's the chair of this department. No one is accusing her of not being the chair of these departments at NYU. No one is accusing her of not being smart or academically rigorous. You know, it's just that letter. Like, this is what makes me so angry when someone is being accused of sexual misconduct and other people step up and they're like, oh, well, I know them. They're great. You weren't there, right? You don't know. I'm friends with plenty of people, and if someone said behind closed doors they're a monster, I'm not there behind closed doors, but it's just them too. So I would have to say, I've never seen that behavior from XYZ person, but I'm not with them 24/7. I don't know their heart. I don't know what they're like. You know, it really adds fuel to this idea that people who are your buddies, people who are nice, people who are accomplished can't also be harassers.
I mean, it sucks when someone that you like, it turns out that they are a harasser, but that's how accountability works. You have to hold everyone accountable, even if they are a friend of yours or someone that you respected.
Yeah, I actually am kind of going through this a little bit personally, where a very prominent person on the left, Keith Ellison, who I personally really like, and is, you know, just won his primary yesterday, is being accused by an ex of domestic violence, pretty serious stuff. And, you know, we're all sort of like circling the wagons and blah, blah, blah. And I kind of have no horse in the race, you know. In my view, these kinds of things, I mean, I don't know what happened in that situation. In my view, and the data would back me up, people don't tend to make up allegations of abuse, right? Like, the statistics are very clear that it's very unlikely that someone is making up a story to get attention for whatever reason, whatever. But it's been interesting watching my professional political circles. A lot of people say, I've worked with him very closely. I consider him to be an ally. Like, I've never seen this behavior. I guess what I'm saying is, it's okay to support your buddy or your friend if they're accused of something and you don't think they did it. If I were in this case, I would think it's fine to, like, call your friend and be like, listen, I don't know what's going on, but let me know if you need to talk, that kind of thing. But you don't need to sign a public declaration putting your reputation on whether or not they did it. Because I just would never do that. Like, if my best friend was accused of something awful, I would call them and be like, I'm here for you. I don't know what happened. But it's like, you don't know. You know, even someone you think you know, you work with every day, you don't know what they're like behind closed doors. And I just can't imagine being so certain that this person didn't do what someone said they did just because we were buddies, just because I thought they were great. You know, that's just not how humans are. There are things about me my closest friends don't know. That doesn't include abuse and sexual harassment, but, like, people are vast and have sides of themselves that even their closest buddies and their closest coworkers and stuff don't know about. And so that's why I always blows my mind when people put their name and reputation on, I know XYZ, they're a good person, they would never do this.
Yeah, and I'm going to assume the women that signed this letter, they had read the emails that were released and the text messages.
Right, because I don't see how you could be a professor and read these emails and think nothing untoward is happening. Clearly something's happening. She talks about kissing him. So if you're an academic and you know, okay, well, I can put two and two together and deduce from this email that she is acknowledging that they kiss. And even if they're both adults, let's say that even if it was consensual in some capacity, in my view, she still has a power imbalance over him. You know what I'm saying? Like, even if it's two adults, if you are a professor and you are having a sexual relationship with someone, like, you're the person that you're advising, you have intense control over their academic and professional career, probably more than anybody else. So this guy's alleging that it wasn't consensual, but even if it was, there's still a huge power imbalance. And I would think that Judith Butler would know that. I would think that Spivak would know that because they write about this for a living. They study this for a living. And so it's just really shocking to me that when it comes to your buddy, you can't see it, you know?
Kind of reminds me of in our episode about Terry Crews, we talked about that very poor taste joke about male rape in prison. And there's also another joke that makes me cringe that I see a lot is that, like, when it's a female teacher, professor going after a younger student, like, of course he's going to want it and be into it, right? Like, high fives to his friends, which is gross and wrong. It's just a double standard for how, if it was a male professor going after a female student, how it would be viewed and talked about in the media versus a female professor and a male student.
Yeah, we could do a whole episode around that, but wrong is wrong. It doesn't matter. Yeah, it's like I see that double standard too, and I hate it. And it's so gross. I think that men should be insulted by that. That, you know, if you're a 15-year-old boy having a sexual relationship with a 22-year-old teacher, maybe you don't have the emotional maturity or wherewithal to understand how that's going to negatively impact you later in life. But we're almost like not allowing men to be emotionally complex creatures. And just saying, oh, men are just horn dogs, and it doesn't matter if it's an adult or if it's a healthy sexual situation, that dude's gonna love it. It's like, no, men are also complex people, and it's almost like not giving them credit for being complex emotional creatures. It's like, it just assumes that men are just horn dogs who wanna get it any way they can get it, and that's just not true. It's not fair. It breaks my heart when men and boys are sexually abused by women, and they worry that speaking out about it will make them be less of a man, will make people question their masculinity. And it's like, you know, in that Terry Crews episode, it's no wonder why men don't speak up. It does not surprise me at all, because we have all of this unfair sexualized stuff when it's a man who is the target of sexual violence. And it's messed up. It makes me upset. So this letter does something else that is, I think, is a hallmark of when men are accused of sexual misconduct. it sort of points out that this professor is brilliant and that, you know, the loss of her brilliance if she was fired for her own behavior would be such a loss for the academic community. They write, if she were to be terminated or relieved of her duties, the injustice would be widely recognized and opposed. The ensuing loss for the humanities, for New York University, and for the intellectual life of these times would be no less enormous and would rightfully invite widespread and intense public scrutiny. We ask that you approach this material with a clear understanding of the long history of her thoughtful and successive mentorship, the singular brilliance of this intellectual, the international reputation she has rightly earned as a stellar scholar in her field, her enduring commitments to the university, and the illuminated world she has brought to your campus, where colleagues and students thrive in her company and under her guidance. First of all, if she were to be fired, the only person that would be to blame for her losing her job or for any ensuing loss to the academic community or the humanities or for the college would be her. She sent those emails. She sent those texts. That was her choice. If anyone would be to blame, it would not be the university or this person who is making these accusations. It would be her. She is an adult with a job. She is the one with the power, not her lowly grad student. If anybody was to blame for what they're saying would be this massive loss to the community or whatever the f***, it would be her. And frankly, if you're somebody who is stupid enough to be sending text messages like this and traceable emails like this, maybe you aren't that brilliant after all. Maybe people have just told you that you're brilliant and you have tenure, so you think you're brilliant. Like, somebody who sends messages like this is a cavalier person who does not strike me as someone who is concerned with what they can bring to this academic community. And that should be squarely on them.
Yeah, and the idea that being brilliant shields you from, like, you can't be punished for any wrongdoing or that you shouldn't be, that's ridiculous and not how things work, or not how they should work anyway. Diane Davis, chair of the Department of Rhetoric at the University of Texas Austin, who also signed the letter to the university supporting Professor Rennell, said she and her colleagues were particularly disturbed that, as they saw it, Mr. Reitman was using Title IX, a feminist tool, to take down a feminist. Quote, I am, of course, very supportive of what Title IX and the Me Too movement are trying to do, of their efforts to confront and to prevent abuses, but for which they also seek some sort of justice. But it's for that very reason that it's so disappointing when this incredible energy for justice is twisted and turned against itself, which is what many of us believe is happening in this case.
Yeah, I wouldn't even call Title IX a feminist tool. The person who originated Know Your Title IX points out that most of the people who use it to get justice are women. But this idea that only, I think that understanding only fuels the idea that men can't be victimized and only women are victims. We know that's not true.
Well, and also, I mean, feminism is about equality. So saying like only women can use Title IX, I think undercuts what feminism is.
I completely agree. So you might be wondering, again, who in their right mind would sign an open letter supporting their colleague who had been accused of sexual misconduct when they, in fact, admit they don't have all the details? If you followed the conversation around Juno Diaz and him and his, you know, allegations of sexual misconduct, you'll remember that many people in his academic community and his fellow scholars and colleagues signed a letter and spoke up saying that they did not want him to be terminated. So it does happen. The Atlantic actually provided some context into why that might be. One factor, universities are hierarchical. They write, at the apex is the chief executive officer, often a president or chancellor, and under that person are the deans of individual schools within a university. Then there are the heads of schools, often decentralized academic departments, who typically enjoy immense influence over departmental decisions, from salaries to curriculums. Less officially, tenured professors hold a great deal of sway, determining their own research and teaching priorities while getting some say over departmental decisions. At the bottom, the untenured academics, hourly wage adjuncts, grant-fueled researchers, contracted instructors, and the like. Overseeing all of this are schools' governing bodies, boards of trustees, for example, which are often composed of leaders from outside the university who come with their own set of financial interests, political beliefs, and personal networks. This leads to a tendency toward tribal politics, in which professors tend to be loyal to their discipline and department. So basically, if you're at an academic university, there can be this weird hierarchy where you cannot want to go against someone if they are perceived as having a lot of power in your department.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who work in academia, and I've heard them talk about stuff like this and how it was upsetting. I mean, they got into the field because they love knowledge and they love learning more, and there are all these politics that impact it and that make it difficult and that have kind of demoralized my friends who are working in academia.
Yeah, some of y'all might know that I'm a PhD school dropout, and I can absolutely attest to what your friends are saying. And that was one of the reasons. I mean, there were many reasons why I dropped out of my program. But one of them was that I was so overwhelmed by the amount of sort of politics and networking and wheeling and dealing. And it felt like this invisible network of like tripwires that I was never going to figure out, right? I was never going to figure out whose ass I should kiss and whose ass I didn't have to kiss. I was never going to figure out, you know, who I should buddy up to if I wanted the best teaching assignment or the best whatever. I was already struggling in a program that I had no business in. On top of, you know, drowning in schoolwork, I didn't have the like mental or emotional energy to also wheel and deal in that way. And that I hate to say it, that is a big part of grad school, at least in my program. I can't speak to every program, but knowing how to navigate what often felt like a tense network of intersecting relationships was a big part of it. And I just had I was already so completely overwhelmed with the actual schoolwork. I had no ability to also factor that stuff in.
Yeah, it takes a toll. And on top of that, securing grant money, that sounds like it plays a big role as well and creates power imbalances. And in his 1998 book on the dynamics of higher education in the U.S. and around the world, the Australian social scientist Brian Martin argued that in academia, like any other hierarchy, quote, people exercise power not by virtue of their personal talents, but by virtue of the position they occupy. With some exceptions, he suggested that a professor's position on the university pyramid and their informal alliances determine the extent to which the individual can escape accountability for his or her actions. Academics in lower tiers are very dependent on the good graces of their supervisors and others with influence over promotional decisions. If an academic in the upper echelons of the power structure commits some wrongdoing, his or her subordinates might feel pressured to disregard it or to come to the professor's defense. And this dynamic also, according to some adjuncts, enables bullying.
Yeah, that is pale as old as time during my time trying to get my PhD. That was exactly my experience. And I didn't make it very far along in my program. You know, I dropped out pretty early on. And so my experience was only ever as a adjunct, as a TA, as a graduate assistant. When I was teaching at Howard, I was a full-time but untenured instructor, which actually was the best experience I ever had because there were so many of us. And Howard, as a practice at the time, did not employ adjuncts, at least in my department. And so you did feel like you had some power in numbers because the university really needed us. Like if we had all walked off the job, the university, the English department would like cease to exist. But in other university settings, you know, when you are a TA or an adjunct, you just don't feel like you have a lot of power. And it's such a dependent relationship. Like, whoever your mentor is, that can be the difference between whether or not you can pay your rent or not, whether or not you have to move home or not, or drop out or not, you know, whether or not you get funding for a project or you get a teaching assistantship. Like, that can be the difference between you eating or not. And when you're an adjunct, if anyone's out there who's been an adjunct, you make such bad money. Like for like 3 months work, you might make like, you know, $1,500, you know, the amount of money I made when I was adjuncting, and I was driving all over the state, right? Like I would, in one morning, I would be at University of Maryland, and then the next, and 2 hours later, I'd be in Arlington teaching at another college. It was a very tenuous professional time in my life, and you just really don't have a lot of power. And unless you're like independently wealthy, it's such a tenuous situation that, I mean, I would be terrified to speak up if something like this happened, if I was an adjunct or a graduate assistant or a TA.
And we're talking about academia right now, but a lot of this, a lot of what we're talking about reflects other things in Me Too or people who commit sex crimes, like the support of colleagues of Rennell in that letter, defending her brilliance. Like we heard that after Louis C.K., after Woody Allen, after Roman Polanski, or his contributions are very valuable to the field. Like we heard that after Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein. Yeah, we just hear this a lot. It's reflecting in what we're talking about today.
Yeah, and it just goes to show that it really is about power. Who is perceived as having it and who is perceived as worthy of protection and worthy of support. And I hadn't even thought about this, but if you were at NYU, if you were in this program and you saw the way these very important people, I mean, Judith Butler is hugely, hugely, hugely influential in this field. If you were someone who was marginalized or, you know, you were a TA or an adjunct or something, and something had happened to you, and you saw the way these hugely important figures circled the wagons to throw the accuser under the bus and be like, oh, we know the accuser. We know that they're full of it. Wouldn't you stay silent? I mean, it just creates this atmosphere that certain people will get protected and certain people will be thrown under the bus. And you have to decide which one you want to be.
I would think twice before speaking out. If I saw this go down, and a part of me probably in the back of my head, I would be like, I'll just wait it out, or I'll just try to minimize my contact.
And I think that's something that bugs me so much is that, and I know I'm like focusing on Judith Butler, but like reading Gender Trouble in undergrad during my, you know, getting a degree in women's studies, that was a foundational feminist text for me. And I'm just so disappointed in her. Like, Judith Butler, if you hear this, I really looked up to you, and you were foundational in me understanding my role in this world as a woman and as a feminist, and I'm really disappointed in you. This hurts, and I think that friendships are important, but I think you need to understand how many people out there, you are a model of what it means to be a feminist for a lot of us, and you gotta know what this feels like for us. I'm really disappointed in Judith Butler. And this is really kind of affirming for me as someone who is like, fuck academia, you know, that the politics that are involved in academia get to people and they lose themselves. They lose their sense of integrity and they can write the most badass takedowns and you know, screeds on feminism, on what it means to be a woman, what it means to be queer, what it means to be anything. And they're still not above being infected by this bullshit politics of academia and egos and power. And I mean, power corrupts, I guess is what I'm saying. And I guess I would have thought that these feminist leaders would have more integrity. And I'm just very disappointed in how this is all shaken out. I mean, you saw those emails. You saw that she talks about kissing her grad student in those emails. She does not say she didn't send those emails. She knows she sent them. Like, how do you account for that? How do you square that circle? I need to know, you know? I feel personally invested in this in a weird way.
It really sucks. We have a little bit more to talk about here, but first we're going to take one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. The bottom line is nobody is above the law, not because they're brilliant, not because they're accomplished, not because they're a woman, not because they're your buddy. No one is above the law.
Olivia Goldhill puts this really well at Quartz. She writes, in a society that takes sexual violence seriously, all accusations must be investigated. Suggesting that an investigation ahead of any decision is in and of itself an injustice shows a total lack of concern for victims of this widely underreported crime. Many of those who signed this letter defending Rennell are feminist theorists who support these principles in theory. In practice, there should be no exceptions to these rules, even when the professor under investigation is a woman. And she puts it so well, I could not agree more.
Me too. And like she said in that quote, and like we said at the beginning, this is a really underreported crime, and dismissing someone, an accuser of an underreported crime, is doing more damage, is having ripple effects for people who maybe were thinking about speaking up about harassment they're facing. And then to see this, it just has a lot more damage than I think at first glance some people might realize.
Yeah, one of my good friends, she once put a status on Facebook that said something along the lines of, if we know that a lot of us out there are the victims or have been the victims of sexual violence, and we don't often speak up, think about how those people are perceiving what you're saying. You know, think about the people who are watching and listening. They may not say, hey, what you're saying is victim blaming. Hey, what you're saying is wrong. But they're there. We're listening. We're watching. And keep that in mind, you know? Like, I'm sure Judith Butler and Dr. Spivak are thinking, this is a one-off thing with someone that we like. Let's do her the solid of speaking up on her behalf. But people are listening. People are watching. People are absorbing the messages that you're giving when you do that kind of thing.
So that brings us to the end of this episode and to listener mail. And we have another letter about fanfiction today. Sarah wrote, my perception of fanfiction was, and to some degree still is, marred by the sort of stigma you discussed in your episodes. Whenever I finish a show or book that I really enjoy, I go through the mild depression that many people do when I can no longer experience the story. This can sometimes be very hard on me, and I've looked down on myself for essentially not being able to get over it and move on in the real world. Because I was so ashamed of this tendency, I would look down on people who read or write fanfiction as the people who couldn't get over it, like I always forced myself to. This winter, I went into a depressive episode that both coincided with and was complicated by my first entry into the world of fanfiction. I think I was already depressed and therefore let myself start reading a fic because I felt so generally bad. Then I felt ashamed that I'd done so and became even more depressed. This continued in a vicious cycle until, a month or two later, I finally said, "F it," and started writing out my own story idea. After writing, editing, and sitting on the story for a few months, I posted it on AO3. It got fantastic reviews in the comments, and with this unexpected external affirmation, I essentially came out of the worst of my depression overnight. I have issues with embarrassment and shame in many aspects of my life, and I've struggled to tell people that I've been writing fan fiction. However, these episodes of the podcast helped me identify the outside reasons why fan fiction is stigmatized and helped me feel like reading and writing it is a valid hobby that many people participate in. I also used some of the points made in these episodes as springboards to tell my friends and family that I'd been writing fan fiction. They've all been very happy for me, both because of the positive feedback I've received and because I've found a creative outlet. Writing fan fiction has been a very powerful and therapeutic experience. I've always wanted to write, but I have been limited by how hard it can be to invent new characters and worlds from scratch. Creating a plot line within pre-established universe broke down that barrier to entry, letting me explore my writing abilities right out of the gate. After the first kit fic, I wrote a fic centered around a female character that I strongly identify with from one of my favorite shows. In this fic, I explore emotions of failure and loss of control that I felt in my own life, but in an amped up, intensified way that's possible in the high-stakes situations that occur in the action-adventure universe of the show. By writing out how this character experiences and eventually overcomes these emotions, I stumbled into several aha moments applicable to my own anxiety and depression. As an aside, because I've had so many issues around embarrassment and because this story has themes of not writing off your successes in the face of your failures, I'm going to make a shameless plug for this fic, which I'm very proud of. It's called The Gale, set in the Voltron Legendary Defender universe and posted on AO3. One person said it was the best fic they've ever read, and someone else actually proclaimed it literary genius. Many people have told me I'm excellent at depicting emotions and made them cry multiple times. Based on this feedback, I'm planning to submit it to a fanfic contest just for fun. If that sounds interesting to you, please go check it out. It's rated roughly teen and up for language and depiction of injury and medical procedures. I love this so much. Congratulations on the great review, Sarah. I've been meaning to check it out. I can't wait to read it. I'm really glad that fan fiction helped you kind of learn more about yourself and how to deal with your depression. I relate so much to this, like writing a fan fiction and later realizing like I was dealing with something in a way that I didn't know how. So I was dealing with it through fan fiction and sort of coming to solutions through fan fiction. And it makes me really happy that you found this outlet, this avenue for creativity.
Yeah, I love that too. I mean, you say that it almost snapped you out of a depression almost overnight. That's incredible. I also like way to give a shameless plug. I can't wait to read this. So go read Sarah's fan fiction because it sounds amazing. Evelyn wrote, Annie asked us to give you some insight into how the closed door policy works in Europe. Well, I'm from Hungary, and in our household, closing the door is not a common thing. This is my experience from my own and my friends' lives. Others might see it otherwise. Also, I live in an apartment complex, a very common thing in Hungary. Mine is a huge 10-story building. For closing your door on your family in a tiny apartment like this, you usually need a good reason. It might be because, A, you go to sleep at night. B, your mom is cooking and you don't want the smell to come in. Though most of the time, you just need the smell to come in. It's way too good. C, you're listening to the same song over and over again, so your mom proceeds to march into your room and scream at you while shutting your door. Same. D, you have friends over, and y'all are way too loud for your mom's liking, and she doesn't want to listen to y'all giggle. E, you and your mom both have your windows open, and the blowing wind outside the flat is way too much for your mom, so she marches to your room again to scream and close the door. Oh, and this is only closing the door. If you lock the door, that's the equivalent of you either A, being very, very extremely mad at your family, or B, having sex. In the case of A, I've only ever done this once in the middle of a hissy fit, and it was not well received. And in the case of B, you must lock the door because knocking is a small and significant thing for parents sometimes. I hope I could give you some insight into the Hungarian closed door policy. That is hilarious.
It is.
I'm like dying laughing. Also, this reminds me of me, like my mom coming in and slamming the door because I'm listening to the same whole song over and over again. Yeah, I would fit right in Hungary.
Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten about sleepovers and my room was above my parents' room and it was really creaky. So like 2 a.m., we would hear the door open and we would all like hop into beds or sleeping bags and pretend to no one, we're fooling no one, that we'd been asleep this whole time.
I love it. Yeah, that was my experience as well.
So thanks to both of them for writing in. We would love to hear from you. If you'd like to write to us, our email is momstuff@howstuffworks.com.
And you can find us on Instagram at Stuff Mom Never Told You and on Twitter at Mom Stuff Podcast.
And thanks, as always, to our producer, Kathleen Quillian.